Radio EcoShock.
You can divide the human population into two kinds of people, those who have experienced a major earthquake and those who have not. Each thinks differently. Robert S. Yates says we don't think about quakes nearly enough. Sooner or later, likely sooner, a megacity somewhere in the world will be hit with something that makes the 9/11 terrorist attack in New York look small. His new book is Earthquake Time Bombs, and he should know. Bob Yates is a professor emeritus in geology from Oregon State University. He's the author of the book Living with Earthquakes in California and co-author of The Geology of Earthquakes. Bob, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what got you started on earthquakes?
Well, I was working for a consulting firm in Southern California after an earthquake in 1971, and it destroyed a new hospital. Well, the hospital was 4 months old, and the earthquake happened, and it completely demolished the hospital. And I'm a structural geologist, and I realized that this earthquake happened on a fault, which is what I study. In fact, I'd been working for Shell Oil Company, and we were studying faults because they're possible sources of oil and gas exploration. And I said, this is really what I want to do, rather than I write papers for my colleagues, my professional colleagues, but I feel it's more important with the books you mentioned to write for the general public, for the people in your audience and other similar audiences.
And moving forward, 5 years ago, you were interviewed by Scientific American. You told them Port-au-Prince in Haiti was in jeopardy due to a major fault line and the lack of money to prepare. A week later, 100,000 people died in a catastrophic quake. Was that just chance?
Yes. Port-au-Prince had an earthquake in the 18th century. Prior to Haiti becoming independent, it was still a possession of France at the time. And the one thing that stood out at the time of the interview was that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Two things, that plus the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are migrating toward the capital, toward Port-au-Prince. And the other thing is that there's a big fault, runs right outside the capital city, and this fault had motion in the 18th century. And so I knew, as a geologist, that this place is going to have an earthquake. However, I didn't know that it was going to happen a week after my interview. That was completely serendipitous, if you will. It went viral because of that fact, but nonetheless, we could not predict that earthquake. And, of course, that's part of our problem. Since we can't predict them here in Oregon, people say, well, okay, there's going to be an earthquake someday, but I got to spend lots of money fixing my house and fixing my school, so I'll just put it off, you know. And that's our problem, trying to convince people that they need to take action, they need to do it now before a lot of people get killed.
Well, now, later I'm going to ask you about the theory that climate change could lead to more earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, but I'd like to leave that for now. Let's look at what we can learn from the deadly earthquake in Kathmandu, Nepal, not the smaller one that hit in February 2016 this year, but the big one in April 2015. Tell us what happened.
Okay, Nepal lies on a plate boundary. It's the boundary between the Indian plate, which is pushing northward from over the past 60 million years, and the Eurasian plate, which is to the north, which is mainly Tibet. And so this place has had some big earthquakes. They had an 8.1 in 1934. Unfortunately, it couldn't be studied by an international group because Nepal was a closed country in 1934. And so the British in India couldn't get up there, and the Nepali people couldn't get down to India. So that really went reported, but it didn't have the analysis that you would get today. And that was part of the problem. People have been saying this is going to have another big earthquake, and I guess the discussion has been, is could there be a bigger one? Could there be an 8.5 or a 9? Right now I'm reviewing a paper in the Nepal area, a scientific paper submitted by a team of Indian seismologists. They're saying that in 1255 AD, which is just only like yesterday to a geologist, The 1255 earthquake had happened in from Kathmandu East, and it was an 8.6. That's a real big earthquake. And then, of course, not so many people live there. But now the place is very heavily populated, and people in some places are well prepared. Most places, though, they're not. And so a lot of people died, but nonetheless, it could have been a lot worse.
Well, aside from the thousands of poor people killed and the hundreds of thousands left homeless, some World Heritage sites were destroyed almost before our eyes. Where modern buildings stood, what are we supposed to do to preserve the treasured past?
Well, I have a colleague named Brian Tucker. He'd be another good one to have on your show. He's a seismologist. He just visited me last week. He's a seismologist, and the difference is he formed a firm that was a nonprofit called Geohazards International. And so he has devoted his life and that of and his colleagues to getting people ready to answer that very question as to how do you prepare. And he started out with Nepal. He started out with Kathmandu and formed a group situated in Kathmandu. He trained people to deal with the problem, Nepalese to deal with the problem. And as a result, you would say, well, 9,000 people died. That's a horrible number. But nonetheless, I think it had not been for the people really getting on the ball after about 2001, I think, when this was started. It would have been several times that. It would have been much, much worse. So there are people who are dealing with this, and Nepal is sort of getting there, you know. It could have been a lot worse, this earthquake that happened, or the two earthquakes that happened in April and May. But nonetheless, they've got a long way to go.
Well, as you've pointed out, there has been a rush of people out of the countryside and into urban slums all over the world. And how does that new trend combine with the geology underneath?
Well, I think the migration of people to major cities worldwide, both those in earthquake country and those not in earthquake country, is the largest migration of people in human history. Port-au-Prince was a perfect example of that. The 18th century earthquakes, the loss of life there was probably in the dozens, just because very few people live there. But now, in fact, they've never really gotten a good agreement on how many people died in that earthquake in 2010. The general consensus is it was almost 200,000 people, but it's sort of hard to get a good number. But it was large. It was large mainly because there were so many people living there. You know, the government is still in terrible condition. They're trying to put another president in office, and there's a lot of stuff going on that I'm not qualified to talk about. But nonetheless, it's a basket case of a country in terms of preparing for earthquakes. In the book that I have written, that the interview with Scientific American got me thinking about this, and I said, you know, I'm a geologist, and I know about plate tectonics, and I know about earthquakes. Is it more important for me to write to other people like myself, or is it more important to write for people like yourself and your audience, and trying to get people to prepare all over the world? And there are places that are in the news for other reasons, like Caracas, Venezuela, for example. And it's one of the time bombs. In 1812, there was an earthquake that killed 10% of the population of that province of Venezuela. But under Chavez's government and under the present government, they've got a lot of other problems that are bothering them, mainly people trying to get the president to resign. And so earthquakes aren't on their list. It's going to have a big earthquake, and the government will be quite unprepared, although there are some scientists there, one of them is a good friend of mine, who are leaders in the study of earthquakes throughout South America. But it's just the government, the bureaucracy is just in their way. They can't get anyone to pay attention, and that probably even includes the press, the media. You know, they've got all these political problems after the death of Chavez that they don't have time to think about it. And as I say, my colleagues in Venezuela can't predict when the next earthquake is going to strike, so we put it off, right?
Yeah. You know, I spent 25 years, Bob, in Vancouver, Canada, always being predicted that there will be a big one there. We had bug-out packs by the front door in case the quake came. We were afraid for our kids who went to an old brick school every day. The government always promised to reinforce those schools, but never got around to it. You know, if a couple of bridges fell in Vancouver, that place would be cut off from the outside aid, except by ship or air. How does all that look to you?
Well, in Oregon, we had a study done by a committee which was authorized by the legislature, and it had specialists in seismology and geology and city planning and so forth. Look at just what you're talking about. What are the probabilities and what should we be doing? And they pointed to bridges. In fact, they did a study of every major bridge in Oregon, and they concluded that a lot of these bridges are obsolete. They're likely to collapse in an earthquake. And so that was presented to the 2015 session of the legislature, which had authorized this committee. You know what they did with it? Nothing. They didn't do anything. They had a bill, sort of a transportation bill, and they took no action on it. It got involved in politics. So the bridges, including, I live part-time in Newport, Oregon, including a bridge that's just a few miles from my house. That bridge was built in the 30s. It does not meet modern standards. It's likely to collapse, and if it collapses, I'm not going to be able to travel between Corvallis, where I live, and my house at the coast. And not only is the place going to be cut off, it'll mean that the people who are doing business there won't be able to deal with their market. And so that could mean that people leave Newport. Not only bridges, but also fiber optic cables, we could be completely cut off. But nonetheless, the legislature, and they just had a short session that just closed earlier this month, never came up. I mean, they've been presented with this study, and the media has sort of covered it, but not enough people like yourself who are trying to spread the word. It's very frustrating, you know, we're doing our thing. And we're trying to tell people about it, but we're trying to get folks to pay attention. You know, there's a lot of unreinforced masonry buildings in Portland. And when one of the city commissioners, a guy named Steve Novick, thought that there ought to be a mandatory retrofit of these old buildings because people are going to die in those buildings, the unreinforced masonry guys got together and they formed an organization called the Brickers. And they said, fine, reinforce the buildings if you like, but you have to pay for it. We're not going to pay for it. This is despite the fact that there are people living and working on those buildings that will die when a building collapses around them. I mean, some of them are not usable just because they're old. I find that really, really frustrating.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Robert Yates. We're talking about his new book, Earthquake Time Bombs. You know, when I was young, I was in the deadly 1971 earthquake in Los Angeles.
Oh, that's the one that got me started.
Well, there you go. We were both there at the same time, and it was a scary experience.
Well, it was scary to me, too. I lived there.
Yeah, it was 6 in the morning or something. Everyone ran outside in their underwear, in my case. We had to look for teetering palm trees. They have small roots, incidentally, and power poles. But that did seem better than being crushed in the house. But you write that it's a mistake to go outside during a quake. Why is that?
I think in the book, when I write about earthquakes that have happened, say like the 49 Seattle earthquake, there's a natural tendency to run outside. You know, it's rattling, I was in an earthquake in Mexico City at which this happened. You know, it was glasses were breaking, people were swearing in Spanish and stuff. And so what'd we do? You know, here I am, I'm supposed to know what I'm doing. We ran outside. Well, the problem with running outside is that if the building is unreinforced, and these buildings were kind of clapping together, they were built real close together, you know, what it could have meant is these bricks fall on us and we'd be killed. And the 49 earthquake, there was a big guy there tending bar, and they had the earthquake, and people jumped up and wanted to run outside, and he went to the door, wouldn't let them out. And so all those lives were saved just because this one guy, the bartender, just happened to have the presence of mind of saying, no, 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 it's dangerous out there. And true enough, once they quieted down, they went out and there's just nothing but bricks piled around the door. They'd all been killed by falling bricks.
And the second lesson for me from that Los Angeles quake is that the first 3 days can be the test of surviving well or not at all. Gas lines blew up, electricity went out. In a worse quake, food deliveries would stop, maybe stores would be looted and empty. And there are frightening aftershocks during all that. Talk to us about surviving after the quake.
Here, this again involves preparation. And I talk about that in one of the books. I have a book called Living with Earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, which includes you in Vancouver. And this book discusses things like that. It discusses reinforcing your house, what you should do. And it sort of addresses all those questions. But, yeah, there are ways to, I mean, don't run around looking for damaged places and getting in the way of rescue operations. You know, whether people pay attention to that remains to be seen. But in our case up here, in your case, all of our cases here in the Northwest, we know the earthquake history of the Cascadia subduction zone for the last 10,000 years. Because when the earthquake happened, it caused sort of a slump, sliding deposits coming off down the continental slope. And these produced deposits that my colleague and former student, Chris Goldfinger, has actually dated those. And so we got 10,000 years of record. And so based upon that, you can do a probability analysis. Chris has calculated that there's about a 15% chance in the next 50 years that you're going to have a magnitude 9 earthquake, which would include you as well as us. And there's a larger chance, say a 30 or one chance out of three, to have an earthquake of, say, magnitude 8.5. And that sounds like, are you going to get hit by a Jeep or a Mack truck? But nonetheless, there's a big difference in response between an 8.5 and a 9. And so we know that we have this bit of information that we can tell the people up in the Pacific Geoscience Center up in Sydney, near you, are fully aware of that. They're very much involved in the search. There's a guy named Roy Heineman. He's a real good guy, well-spoken. He's written about this, and he's like me, you know. He says, okay, I'm a specialist, but I need to talk to fellow Canadians about what I do. I can't just sit here and just write papers for other people like myself. So Canada's kind of on board. There's a guy in Ottawa named John Adams, who's a New Zealander, and I knew him as a New Zealander first. And John has also been one of the real international leaders.
Well, having lived through an earthquake, I have to tell you it was one of the most frightening moments of my life, and I found myself a little resistant to talking about them or to you. Is that an after effect, a kind of trauma that's common to people after a quake?
Probably. I know that after I experienced an earthquake in Mexico City in the late 70s, people were killed. You could hear sirens going off. And what did? We ran outside. Did exactly the wrong thing. Here I am supposed to know what I'm doing, but we ran outside. So later on I said, man, was I lucky or what? I mean, it's a completely odd thing to happen. You don't expect it to happen. And indeed, the last big one to happen in Cascadia was in January of 1700 AD, which was before the Lewis and Clark expedition. You know, but geologic time has its own time frame.
Yeah. Now, look, I want to talk about a couple of other places in the world. Right now, Turkey's almost in a civil war. The buildings collapse there from time to time just because of poor building standards. Is there a quake risk in Turkey as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a big time. Turkey, however, Istanbul is a different situation. I've been to Istanbul and worked on it, and I've been to the big fault. There's a fault that runs right offshore from Istanbul called the North Anatolian Fault. And it had a huge magnitude 8 earthquake in 1939 in the very early days of World War II. And you couldn't get there because of the war. But there was a Turkish seismologist and geologist who sent a crew out. They worked on this one and several others that happened still during the war. And he was the first guy in the world to publish the relationship of the earthquake to plate tectonics, even though plate tectonics wasn't even invented, but the idea that the area to the south of Istanbul is going to move with respect to the area within and to the north. So as a result of that, they had a couple of big earthquakes in 1999, and a lot of people died. One of the illustrations in my book is of an aerial shot of an area that was damaged in the 1999 earthquakes. And the interesting thing is that religious buildings, mosques and minarets, they survived just fine. But all the apartment buildings around Istanbul were just big hot piles of rubble, and thousands of people lost their lives. So what that showed me was the Turkish engineers know how to design a proper building, but it's just the corruption is so bad, and people moving to these buildings trying to find work, you know, the big population explosion that was going on in Turkey, they have no political stroke at all, you know. They have nobody looking out for them because they're country people coming in there trying to find work. So as a result, a lot of them were killed. Thousands of them lost their lives in the 299 earthquakes. So after that, there's been another earthquake warning that was issued, three different studies by three different international groups. And so this time, the Turks are taking it much more seriously. I have a colleague at a university in Istanbul called Bogazici, and he has led a campaign along with others, a lot of it by engineers, for preparedness. They have borrowed over a billion euros to try to make this happening, and they're retrofitting schools and retrofitting hospitals. So Turkey's going to come out better. They actually had an earthquake a few years ago in eastern Turkey, and that sort of got their attention again, and so now they may be one of the big success stories. Now, Tehran, just to the east, equally big city, that's another story entirely. I don't think the mullahs, I think if God wills, they'll have an earthquake and nothing they can do about it, although there are very fine, very highly qualified earthquake engineers and geologists. I work with a colleague he's an Armenian Christian, so he was a refugee, came to the U.S., but nonetheless, he's the most knowledgeable person about earthquake in Iran, and he and I are publishing a paper. He's also published stuff in Farsi, you know, to try to get people, and he has colleagues that just think he's great, you know, which I do too. He's one of my heroes. But nonetheless, the government, they're clueless. I don't say they're clueless, they just don't have any interest in this problem. If you can't predict it, inshallah, if God wills, there'll be an earthquake. Not a damn thing we can do about it.
Oh, boy.
So it's really, really sad. And I think the book tries to focus on places like that, Caracas in Guayaquil, Ecuador, you know, and Jerusalem is another one. They have had earthquakes, and they're fairly close to a major plate boundary fault called the Dead Sea Fault, and they have had earthquakes that are recorded in the Bible, actually. I think the Israelis, I have to give them some credit here, in that the Israelis take the earthquake threat much more seriously than, let's say, the Iranians do.
Now, as the tsunami in Japan showed us, and the one in Indonesia that spread across the whole of South Asia, we don't have to be in an earthquake zone to suffer high casualties from a quake in the ocean floor. Did you write about that in this book?
Absolutely. Yeah, in the book, Living with Earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, which is available online, it's free, available for free online, and it describes the tsunami of 1964. Accompanying the Great Alaskan earthquake of that year. And there are people killed in Oregon and more people killed in California. And that tsunami was spread all over the Pacific. Some of the evidence we have from exactly when the last big one, the January 1700 earthquake in Cascadia, the evidence comes from Japan, and the reason is because they recorded that tsunami. They called it an orphan tsunami, and the orphan tsunami didn't have an earthquake associated with it because the earthquake was all the way across the Pacific in our part of the world, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. And so that's been a real detective story, and the Japanese, there's a guy named Kenji Satake who actually used to teach at the University of Michigan, but he's now with the University of Tokyo. But they have done that, and he's worked with a guy named Brian Atwater, who's with the USGS, and I'm sure you've heard of him. There's actually a book about the orphan tsunami that's been published.
Bob Yates, what do you think about the small quakes happening in Oklahoma as a result of fracking? Could a large-scale quake be triggered by fracking?
I'm not sure, and I think my take on the Oklahoma quakes is that they're related to oil and gas conditions. I don't know, and I'm not going to go out on a limb and suggest, except to say that it's almost certainly related. I mean, formerly, before all of this recent activity, when the price of oil was over $100 a barrel, there was almost no earthquakes in Oklahoma and Kansas and adjacent places. And now there are just huge numbers of them. And my guess is this is related to either fluid injection, what they call fracking, or due to wastewater disposal. You know, a lot of when you produce oil and gas, and I'm going to go back to my Shell Oil Company roots here, that fracking is sort of a standard way that you increase productivity in wells. And it was been huge additions have been made in places like North Dakota, which is a major oil-producing state that it was not before. And so the sad thing is that once all this started happening and people started getting upset, it was kind of hard for the state government to take this seriously. Well, we don't know if there's any relation or not. Well, of course there's a relationship. Come on. And so it's a political hazard kind of going on as we speak. But I don't think that the earthquakes, the largest one I know about is a 5.6. I do not believe that those earthquakes are signs of a big earthquake because the faults in Oklahoma are totally different from those in the Pacific Northwest.
We're starting to run low on time. I just want to squeeze in a couple of other things. I want to talk to you about Dr. Bill McGuire. He works at the University College of London's Hazard Research Center, and he's published a book and articles, one in the Guardian newspaper in 2012, saying that the masses of melting ice from Greenland and Antarctica will destabilize existing faults. He expects more earthquakes and more volcanic eruptions because of climate change. I don't see anything about that in your new book, Earthquake Time Bombs. Why not?
I'm not sure that I buy that story. I have not seen the book. It has not received much press. And I don't want to badmouth this guy, but nonetheless, in terms of earthquake prediction, just because we can't do it, there are a lot of people out there who think they can. And so the book does describe a couple of those. One guy who has a PhD in climatology, actually, and he predicted that we're going to have a big earthquake in New Madrid, Missouri, near St. Louis, between St. Louis and Memphis. And he had some sort of theory about the juxtaposition of planets and so forth. And he sold newsletters to people, interested people. And so he said that he actually predicted a date, time for the earthquake. And of course, the media jumped all over it. Yeah, they sent trucks there, you know, and scared everybody to death. And their time came and went, no earthquake. But that's the problem we have. You know, there are people who, and I do write about that. The book has a chapter about when's the next big one. And that book has discussion about some of these, what I call fake predictions. Another guy predicted a big earthquake in Lima, Peru. And he had a PhD. Well, both these guys had PhDs, so watch people that have PhDs. Some of them are you want to listen to and others you don't. And this guy predicted an earthquake in Lima, Peru. Well, Lima, Peru has lots of earthquakes. And so it nearly caused an international incident. And so one of the directors of the National Earthquake Hazards Program actually went to Lima, appeared in the media and said, I'm here. On the day of the earthquake, I'm here because I don't believe there's going to be one, and there wasn't one, and so it all kind of went away. So that's a totally different problem, getting people to take earthquakes seriously, but not to be dissuaded. I'm not saying this guy at the University of London is in that category. I can only say that I haven't heard a thing about this, but I don't think that the melting ice caps of Greenland, personally, I think those aren't going to produce a huge earthquake.
Okay, now we have to wrap up. What do you hope your new book will do?
The purpose of the book is to get people, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, all around the world, to take earthquakes seriously. We have a whole bunch of people who are trying to legitimately forecast an earthquake, and we don't use the term prediction. We don't use the P word anymore, but we do use the term forecast. And what we do is we say, what's the probability? That's what I was saying. Chris Goldfinger has done this. Other people have done it. We have one thing that's kind of cool that I'll tell you about, and that is that there's short-term signals that, for example, an earthquake wave in the ground goes slower, much slower, than the electronic signal that's recorded on a seismograph in Pacific Geoscience Center or Seattle or Port Corvallis, Oregon, for that matter. So you have up to a few minutes to stop if surgery going on, operating rooms. Japan has pioneered this, and so they once they get the signal, they shut down a bullet train. I call that predicting an earthquake after it happens because it's already happened, but your signal hadn't reached you yet, but you still have time. And the Mexicans are perhaps among the best. They're up there with the Japanese because their subduction zone is offshore, but the place that is most greatly at risk is the city of Mexico City, which is built on soft, squishy, jello-like lake clays. And so the damage that was done, it was an earthquake in 1985, and the big damage was done in Mexico City, not on the subduction zone where the earthquake happened. Those are some things that we can do, but we'd like to be able to improve our prediction. And there's kind of a controversy. Some of my colleagues who are seismologists more knowledgeable than me think that the Earth is just too complicated to do this.
Well, my personal early warning system is my dog or my cat. When they take off, I get worried.
That's right. Yeah? Yeah, some people rely on their horse, you know.
Okay. We've been speaking with longtime earthquake expert Robert S. Yates. He's a retired professor emeritus with Oregon State University, an expert in the field, author of works on quakes, and now brings out his new warning book, Earthquake Time Bombs. It's not a technical book, although it is stuffed with fascinating facts, but it's a really good read and a primer for all of us. I enjoyed it. I'll put some links to the quakes and ideas we've talked about in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Bob Yates, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. We'll talk to you again.
I'm Alex Smith. Be sure to follow up with our links to the guests and topics in this week's Radio EcoShock in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.